What's up, everybody? My name is Mike Lee, and I'd like to welcome you to the Mind Shift Lab. Each week, we'll bring you a new guest to share stories, strategies, and mindsets to help you create an internal shift that drives external results in business, sports, and life. Today, we are diving in with Greg Offner. Greg is a keynote speaker, workshop facilitator, and coach speaking on the topics of performance, disruption, and creativity. Greg draws from his experience as an internationally known dueling pianist, combined with his background in corporate leadership and risk management to entertain and inspire audiences throughout the world. Greg, thanks for being here today. It's good to see your face, my man.
You too, Mike. Thanks for having me, man.
So to kick it off here, can you just give everybody a kind of a high-level overview of your journey from where you started to where you're at today to give people context as to who they are getting to listen to and learn from today?
Yeah, it was 1982, and the first thing I saw was a bright light as I crawled out of this tunnel. No, so I won't go that far back, but...
You know what's the last? I had somebody else use that same intro. He's one of the first people that I ever had on here, and he was also a pianist.
Well, he must have been a really good dude.
He used to play the keys for Halsey, and I had him on here. That was the intro. He started out same thing. That was his first journey too. I wonder how that all is coming together. Anyways, go ahead.
Well, I wound up as a keynote speaker, workshop facilitator, you know, sort of a global authority on performance after nearly losing the ability to speak. In 2015, I was living this dual life as a sales executive by day, dueling piano player by night, and, you know, one really paid the bills and the other, you know, really fulfilled me. And through overuse and just some other circumstances going on within my body, my vocal cords got so degraded and so worn out that doctors said if I didn't have immediate surgery and go into months of rehabilitation with my voice, I'd lose the ability to use it forever. And so in that process, those months which turned into years of rehabilitation, I realized that I didn't care enough about that day job to keep doing it, that it wasn't very important to me in terms of what my life was here to do. And that while I loved playing the piano at bars, I wasn't sure that I wanted the rest of my life to be 10 p.m. to 2, 3, 4 in the morning. I didn't want to live that lifestyle. And I found this really neat intersection of my business background and my entertainment background here in the world of keynote speaking and workshop facilitation, because I get to speak on stage, bring the piano into the performance, and entertain and really get business leaders thinking about how their people perform, how they perform at work, and when do they perform at their best, and what leads into that, and how can they bring other people along on that journey and get everyone to perform better.
Awesome, man. So you have something that you share in a lot of your programs, and it's the performance agreement. What mm-hmm. is that? How did you come up with that? And how can we apply that?
Yeah. So the performance agreement is where businesses need to get to if they're going to continue in this new post-pandemic world, if they're going to continue to be successful, continue to attract talent, continue to make an impact in the world. Because frankly, it's an agreement that's been wearing out. It's broken, Mike. It's work sucks. Maybe sucks is a strong word to use, so let's say work is irksome, but people are not happy with the concept of work as we know it. And it's up to businesses to take the lead in reestablishing an agreement between themselves and the people they employ as to what the purpose, what the outcome, what the impact of that performance each day really is. And so the two sides of this agreement, because in every agreement, you know, in every contract, there has to be something you're giving me and something I'm giving you in exchange. The company has a duty, I think it's a moral obligation, to its employees to not just train them in their particular job or in their particular industry, not just to make them better employees, but to make them better people. So when we establish a performance agreement with my clients, what we're doing is getting the leaders of that organization, getting the organization to agree to implement training, implement processes that help make better people, help make their people better, more intrinsically valuable. These are things that may be referred to as soft skills. I hate that term. I like the term tactical, right? These are tactical skills: empathy, negotiation, gratitude, energy management, whether it's just physical energy, like being exhausted at the end of the day, or psychological energy, like being exhausted after dealing with a rough customer or with a difficult employee, understanding how to manage that energy and recharge it. And so the company owes it to their employees to do that. In turn, the employees owe it to their company, and this is where we get buy-in from the employees, Mike, to not just show up for an income, not just get in at 8 or 9, get out quickly at 5, and on Friday expect that check to come in the mail because I was there. We don't need more people to be anywhere. In fact, the pandemic has shown that you don't have to be somewhere to make an impact. And that's what the employees are going to agree to. They're going to agree not to just collect an income, but to make an impact. And what happens when this agreement is created is that better people perform better. And so better people are actually better for business. If you take one attorney that really has no tactical skill, they're not that grateful, their energy level, their resilience is low, very technically sound, they're a good attorney on paper, they know the law. Now you take another attorney that has those tactical skills and you're the hiring manager, you're gonna hire this attorney, they bring more to the table. So as these businesses produce better people, and those people not only show up in their communities better, they show up for their families better, but they show up to work the next day, the same employee just got better. But you made them better at something that matters to them. Because the other part of that work sucks conversation is that nobody really cares about being a better employee. If you think back to 8 or 9 year old Mike, I know certainly 8 or 9 year old Greg didn't give a damn about being a good employee. That wasn't even on my radar. I wanted to be a good person. I wanted to do something for the world that mattered. Maybe I wanted to be an astronaut, a police officer, a fire. It depended on the day. I had a lot of wants. But ultimately, those things were to make my community better, to make the world a better place to be. And so if we approach our people from the standpoint of giving them tools, giving them access to tools that make them better people, we get buy-in, we get engagement, we get commitment like we'd never get if we simply send them to training that makes them a better employee. And that's the performance.
I love
agreement.
It, man. I love it. I think there's, you know, businesses can no longer just pay attention to what happens inside of the four walls of the organization. Obviously, that's different today, but really taking a holistic approach to their people is going to benefit both the people in the long run and the business in the long run. And, you know, I think businesses are up for a, you know, there's people have never demanded more from their work than they are right now. I mean, there's research from Deloitte. I think in 2020, the Human Capital Report said that people were even looking for their place of work, their place of employment to offer opportunities for like their spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like people are looking for so much more than a paycheck. And I think it's going to be, it's up kind of with what you're doing with this performance agreement. It's really rethinking how do we even define work? What does that even mean? And really making it a more holistic, inclusive experience, a part of our life, right? And that's only going to help with retainment and engagement and driving higher performance. One thing that you use for in your performance work is a process called root cause analysis. Can you break that down and share how somebody might apply that today and what that is?
Yeah, and before I do though, I appreciate asking about that. I'll just say that there's a recent survey, really it's a study. There was a study done by the Satel Institute of CEOs. And the Satel Institute is really concerned with corporate social responsibility. 85% of CEOs believe that it's no longer enough for the company to simply make money. They believe the company needs to do good for the communities in which they live. I think that they should be able to have their cake and eat it too. when these companies shift that focus from just training their employees to building better people, and the money's there, not to get off on a tangent, but the global spend on workforce development is $300 billion. The money's there. We're spending the money anyway. So instead of all these extra initiatives that become line item costs for organizations to build corporate social responsibility, why not just make the people better? And then they go out into the community and they're better people. You know, maybe they don't litter. I'd love that. Maybe they hold the door open. Maybe they say thank you. Whatever your idea of a better person is, if every company were focused on creating that, not only does the world, the community, the cities in which they're based get better and get the benefit of that, the business does too. It is a win-win for everyone. So the root goal analysis that you mentioned is a part of this performance agreement. Because you said some people don't like work. What does work even mean, I think you said? That's a really good question that most people shy away from. Similarly with goal setting, we like to set goals for ourselves. I was coaching someone yesterday who said that she sometimes puts goals on her to-do list that she knows she'll knock out just so she can feel good about crossing it out. We often set goals for ourselves that sound good, like I want to drop 10 pounds or I want to get a vacation home. Whatever your goal is, we always have a good reason for everything we say we want to do. We justify it internally. But it's not always the real reason. What we tell others isn't always the real reason. And so what root goal analysis helps the participants, my coaching clients, the organizations that I work with, what it helps them do is get crystal clear on what happens when they achieve a goal. And then we take whatever that answer is and we redo it. We redo it in that process. We say, well, then what happens when you achieve that? And the wording we use, if the folks watching want to do this for themselves, that you take any goal, you know, say your goal is I want to lose 10 pounds, which will allow me to blank. What's that blank? It could, you fill in the blank, could be would allow me to feel better, would allow me to run a 5K, would allow me to play with my children more, right? Whatever that is. Whatever you filled in that blank, then put that at the front and say, I want to run a 5K, which will allow me to feel, you know, accomplished. Well, now we're getting closer to the goal, Mike, because maybe you don't need to lose 10 pounds to feel accomplished. Maybe there's another way to get there. So that's what the root goal analysis does. It breaks down and it simplifies and clarifies what we really, really want, not just what sounds good to talk about in terms of a goal.
Yeah, I think it's super important because so many times, you know, at the reality is, and you were kind of alluding to this, is we don't take action or create goals in order to actually achieve that thing. We take action and go after things because of the feeling that we're going to experience when we achieve those goals. And lots of times there might be, like you're saying, there might be different avenues in order to make that happen. And I think, you know, lots of times, you know, the goal is never the goal, right? What we think we're going after, right? Like losing 10 pounds, whatever it is, right? It's not actually lose 10 pounds. It's because I want to feel more confident when I'm going up to this girl to ask her out or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. It's like there's always something, you know, because, and that's part of what you're talking about with this is like really getting to the foundational layer as to why you really want to go after that. How do you get people to be comfortable enough or vulnerable enough to go that deep? I think everybody's okay with giving that first level answer, mm-hmm. but like getting to the fifth level, how do you get people to go that deep and be vulnerable enough to do that?
Yeah, music. Music's a really good metaphor and it disarms the participants. And that's why I bring what I did, on stage in dueling piano bars and in, you know, theaters, stages all over the world. That's why I bring that into the keynote. Because frankly, I don't want to talk to CEOs. I don't want to talk to vice presidents. I don't want to talk to senior managers. I want to talk to the people. I want to talk to people who are sitting in those chairs. I want to take the title away. I want to take as much of this corporate armor that we clad ourselves in off and just talk to people. I think that's what we've lost in a lot of our day-to-day communication, is that we deal with titles or we deal with social status instead of just dealing with your Mike, I'm Greg. At one point, You couldn't use the toilet at one point. I couldn't use the toilet. We actually have a lot in common if we strip away the titles and the BS. Like, let's talk to each other as people, as human beings. And if we get better as people, then everything else we involve ourselves in, everything else improves by extension.
So you did a bunch of research with 1,000 leaders across 40 different organizations. What was some of this that came through in the research?
It was actually pretty simple. I had one question, and it was a question that had just really gnawed at me. Did you ever get a question like that you're sort of tossing and turning and you can't figure out the answer? And maybe you were like me, that with this question, I was looking in the mirror and wondering, do I just not get it? Because at that point in my life, when I started this investigation, let's call it, I was really grappling with the fact that I thought work sucked. Why would people subject themselves to this every day? I remember I was driving to work. You know, 95 here in Philadelphia is just, it's always been a traffic jam. There's a lot of those self-help memes that say treat yourself like 95 and never stop working on yourself, you know? And so I'm driving down 95 or up 95, and really I wasn't driving, I was stopped, just sort of like inching along and trying to figure out what it was that was holding up traffic. And after about a half hour, I mean, my coffee was gone, so I guess it was about a half hour, I finally saw that there were two cars that had been in an accident, and they were just like getting moved off to the side of the road. Police were helping them move. The drivers, you know, they looked like me. They were wearing suits and talking on their phones and I guess trying to figure out insurance. They're standing there. So nobody was hurt. It wasn't a serious accident. And I thought, man, what a way to start the day. That sucks. This car, like a car accident is like one of the worst ways I think you can start your day. And then I had this thought, those luckies, they don't have to go to work probably. They're going to go to the body shop and drop their car off, and then maybe they'll get a ride home and they're going to get the day off. And I couldn't believe I was sitting there hoping for a car accident, but there I was. And I thought, there's got to be something else to this. So I started asking senior leaders one simple question. How did you wind up working for this company, wherever it was that they worked? It seems like an innocuous question, one that should be easily answered. But most of the looks that I got were deer in the headlights. Huh? Like, what do you mean? And again, I had that gnawing feeling like, is there something I don't get? But Mike, what surprised me is that most of their answers were, there was a job opening, I applied, and they hired me.
There's no intention around it.
There's no passion. This is where you spend your life. Most waking hours of your day will be spent doing this, and your justification is, there was an opening, I asked, they said okay. I mean, my God, no wonder people are disengaged at work. No wonder we beg for snow days and sometimes daydream of car accidents to get out of it. People schedule appointments with their dentist when they should be at work. That should tell you something, that we'd rather be at the dentist than at work. That's not how I believe work should be. Work is more noble. Work is what creates things in life that allows society to improve. We should enjoy what we do. Not every day. Things are going to suck from time to time. But if you go out on the street and ask a couple people, you may not know this, Mike, but the word on the street is the majority of the time people think work sucks. And I want to take the irk out of work. I want to make this a place and a mission that people enjoy. And the piano helps.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple things with that. And I think one thing that's shifted is that, you know, up until 100 years ago, work was something that we did, that we had to do in order to survive, right? It was something that we did to provide for our family. And that was like, you know, up until like 100 years ago, pre Great Depression, that was like the number one goal of parents. Parents, their goal wasn't to raise kids who were successful and fulfilled and happy. Their goal was to raise kids so that they would survive. Right. And now that we've evolved as a society, like we're looking for different purpose within work. And I think, you know, this I see this with like my parents' generation. My parents are like 60, you know, 63, 64. Right. And I think another thing, too, is like, you know, my parents for sure saw their work as a way to support family, right? And so many people are pushing off having kids that they are looking for their work to fulfill more of that need and that purpose, right? Like I'm 39 years old. I don't have kids. My purpose of my work is a very big piece of my life. If I had kids, I think it would be different to find meaning in the work because I saw it as a means to an end to support somebody else that I loved, right? Mm. And I think there's a couple of those things that are, you know, we need to take into account when we're redefining what we think work should mean, right?
Yeah, you caught me up on that last bit, redefining what work should mean. So certainly most people, if we go back to, we really don't care about being good employees, we care more passionately about being good or better people. I mean, that's a concept that you'll see in Abraham Maslow's work. The top of the pyramid there is self-actualization. It's a concept you'll see in Carl Rogers' psychological work, where the highest aspiration that you and I have, that human beings have, is to self-actualize, to become all that we can become. That's why, you know, when we were younger in the, I think, late 80s, the Army slogan, be all that you can be, that's why that was such a powerful call. It wasn't, let's go kick some ass and go to war, right? Nobody necessarily wants to fight in battle. We try to avoid fighting, I think, most of us, sane people. But we'd all love to be all that we could be. That sounds awesome. You're going to help me do that? Great. So that's the clarion call that I'm trying to produce here for workers, is that you may not be in an industry that you're passionate about, but most workers don't have the skills they need to jump industry. Because unless you're doing it yourself, all that your job is going to provide for you right now, most jobs, is stuff that helps you be better at what you're doing currently. So especially if you don't like what you're doing currently, you're disengaged in that as well. So this $300 billion spend, I can't imagine the ROI is even close. A lot of this money is getting flushed down the proverbial toilet. And if businesses would simply focus on helping their people, just like the Army said, be all that you can be, that return compounds significantly. Because now you're selling your customers something they want to buy. We've been trying to jam this down our employees' throats. And then to offset the pain of that medicine, say, well, here's a beer pong table, or, you know, here's free lunch Friday, or here's my favorite, here's the, you know, no vacation time policy. Take as much as you want, which sounds awesome, except when you give your 2 weeks notice, you don't get paid out 2 weeks because you don't have that 2 weeks vacation sitting there. You don't accrue anything. If you don't take it, you didn't take it. Sorry for you. So it's not as magnanimous an offer, I think, as businesses make it sound. But we got to sell our customer, if we're the business, we got to sell our customer what they want. Our employees want to be better people. Help them do that. And in the process, you get better employees. And of course, the technical training is like table stakes. You know, like you can't see the river if you haven't bet. I mean, you got to have the technical skills to play the game. But once you're in, instead of waiting to be a C or a senior executive before you start getting coaching, resilience training, negotiation training, let's give that to the first day employee. Let's make them better and let them make our business better. That's the performance agreement. The company makes the person better. The person makes the company better.
What are some things that organizations can do to create more emotional buy-in to support that agreement?
They can do something of value. I'm so glad you asked that. I'm so passionate about this. I am sick and tired of organizations who see their customers as shareholder. Shareholders, I'm gonna get in trouble for this. Shareholders are the lowest common denominator in any business. And this is this myth of scarcity that Apple likes to talk about, what, you know, when we say, well, if we tax Apple more, they're gonna go to China, they're gonna go wherever they go. A new Apple will show up. There's always someone stepping into a power vacuum. It always happens. But we are, as human beings, our mental conditioning is such that we're more scared of loss than we are interested in pursuing an advantage. That well, we're gonna leave. Oh, please don't leave, please don't leave. We really want you to stay. They're not gonna leave. And if they do, another company's gonna step up and fill their shoes. Similarly with shareholders. If shareholders aren't in it because they're as passionate about your solution as you are, they're the lowest common denominator. The shareholders that are there chasing a return and a return only, there will be other shareholders. Let them go. Because what's suffering as you manage to the quarterly report and you manage to the stock price is the quality of your product, and that's what loses the passion of your employees. Because not only don't people generally want to go to work, they absolutely don't want to go to work for a crappy product, and they certainly don't want to go to work just so they can make some other shareholder rich. I'm not anti-shareholder, and I'm not anti-profit. I want people to make money. But don't make money for the sake of making money. That's what bank robbers do. Make money because what you put out in the world is a step better, is a better solution than what's currently out there. And there aren't enough businesses doing that. There are too many businesses that are just in it to make a buck. I see it in Silicon Valley with a lot of these quick flip unicorn tech companies. You see it in the cryptocurrency world with some of these altcoins. They're not doing anything of substance. They're simply there to let somebody pump up the value. And then a couple folks who got some inside information skirt out real quick with theirs, and everybody else is left holding the bag. Most employees are sick of being the bag holder. We all need to participate and win together. If this economy, if the way that we work is going to continue to work, it's got to change. And the first step to changing that is helping our people be better people, giving them the gift of perspective, of resilience. Because again, some days at work are gonna suck. Some days at work, you gotta eat it and just shut up and keep driving. They're tough days. What helps people do that are those skills, those tactical skills. That's what we need more of.
So one of those is being able to find fulfillment, right? What are some tactical things that people can do in order to do that?
Yeah, I think gratitude is number one. You know, so the perspective shift or reframing is number two. And let's talk about them both. There's a study done in a couple years back. I want to say it was done by UPenn, but maybe not. Don't quote me on that. But it was done about a group of nuns, this cloister of nuns. And they found diaries that these nuns had written for many, many, many years. And what they found as they analyzed the contents of the diaries, they were looking for positive or negative sentiment, meaning, am I optimistic, forward-looking, and hopeful about the future? Am I pessimistic? I don't want to say grounded, but sort of, hey, it is what it is, and it is how it is, and that's how it will always be type of thinking. The nuns who had that optimistic, forward thinking lived on average 10 years longer. Gratitude is the fountain of youth. It's a life extender. And within gratitude is where we find fulfillment. So what leads into that and how we can experience more gratitude is learning the skill of shifting perspective, or what psychologists would call, what you and I would call reframing. I shouldn't say we're psychologists per se, but what people who think about this from a psychological standpoint might say is that it's called reframing. So when I lost my voice, very easy for someone to look at that as a negative. And I did. But very quickly, I said, but what could this do for me? What good could come of this? How can I find a way to leverage this for a better good? And that's what I do with my life now. It's literally my life's work was inspired by losing my voice. The very thing that was my actual financial work and income. And that's what I think is so fascinating about this pandemic, Mike, is that I went through this in 2015. That was my pandemic, right? If you will, my first experience of this. So pandemic, the real pandemic, like that was my second shot at the world stopping and getting clarity of purpose. But for many people, that was the first time that they'd ever had a stoppage and a moment to breathe and think and decide, do I like the direction my life is headed? Am I happy with my position in that journey right now? And what most people realized was that I don't. There's a couple things I'd like to make changes about. And that's what we're seeing. That's what this, you know, this great resignation away from jobs is a direct result of that pause, of the ability to stop and reflect.
Yeah, I mean, with this pause, you know, we're also dealing with a ton of change. I think one thing that will be interesting to see is like people, you know, all the research is out on, I don't know what the exact stats are, but a significant amount of people saying that they're looking for, will be looking for, or are looking for a new job within the next like 12 months or whatever it is, something like that, okay. Right? You probably maybe know the research, right? But like a lot of that also comes with change, right? And change is something that we don't like dealing with. So one thing, you know, that's another thing I know you speak about and coach people through is how to deal with change. What are some, if people are looking to create change right now, what are some things that they can do in order to navigate that in a way that is maybe not as disruptive to their life?
Yeah. So we start with the root goal analysis. Get clear on what that change truly is and what it is that you hope to accomplish from that change. Once you understand exactly...
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How many people do you think would still say that they are, and this is total hypothetical, but it just came to me. How many people do you think would say that they are still looking for a job within the next 12 to 18 months if they went through a process like this, right? This root goal analysis and really got to the depth of why they wanted to change, you know, because a lot of, you know, the media has made this about like remote work and stuff like that. And that's obviously part of it. But a lot of it is like finding purpose and finding belonging and finding fulfillment in our jobs, right? It's not just about being able to work remotely. If people went through this root cause analysis, how many people do you think would actually still want to change jobs, or would they find more clarity around what they really want? Does that make sense?
I understand the question, but I can't answer it. I have no idea. It's sort of like...
As you know, I was asking the question.
Yeah. You know what I think about, Mike, is I think about that Love It or List It show on HGTV, you know, where someone says, I'm not happy with this house. And one realtor comes in and says, yeah, it's because your interior design sucks. We're going to help you rearrange how this house is laid out. That is reframing. That's psychologically, that's reframing. And then others say, well, cool, we're going to go help you look for what you think you want. That's root goal analysis. And again,
that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Most people don't have access to those skills, not because they're not smart enough to. People are super smart. They just don't believe they have the time to develop themselves. They're so busy trying to juggle all these balls of life they've got up in the air, kids, work, soccer, this, that, the other. That personal development comes last for nearly everyone except people like you and me who are in this industry. And businesses are already spending $300 billion a year globally to provide training and development for their people, and yet they're spending 86% of it on technical job-specific training. The remainder gets spent on executive function, but all that is check the box, don't get us sued, don't get yourself fired training, like what not to say in an interview, how not to sexually harass someone, and what to do when you get a complaint. There's virtually no training being done on communication skills, on these tactical skills. And if businesses would only invest in it, then their people could either say, you know what, I just need to reimagine how I look at this job, the parts I don't like, the parts I do like, and find what I can be grateful for and magnify that. Because we're trained fault finders, right? The police never pull you over to say, hey, Mike, man, glad we got you. Just wanted to say you're observing the speed limit, man. And whoo, your lights, they're all functioning great. Thank you for being a safe driver. Nobody does that. You don't go to the doctor and they read off a litany of what's right. You're there to talk about what's wrong. And most of us in our role as humans are looking for faults. We're looking for danger because that's how our brain is conditioned. Be aware of threats. We don't pay as much attention to opportunity. It's a concept in psychology called approach avoidance. And so when we talk about change, there's a change you want to avoid, and then there's a change you want to make. And if more people were living their life pursuing the change they wanted to make, rather than what I call maintaining status quo or trying to push away the change they want to avoid, people would find themselves happier just by that shift alone. So I don't know if that answers your question. It's a fascinating thought experiment, but
Yeah, part of the reason I ask it is I think, you know, we look at our jobs in and of themselves and think this is, it is what it is, right? And so the reason I bring that up is there's a guy named Kirk Sauter who works with, he coaches people on how to essentially use their careers, find purpose within their careers, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that might be taking another job, starting something new. And sometimes lots of times in his work, he's found that he will work with them to create something within the position that they're already in, right? To use what they already have, use those resources as a vehicle to create something. And, you know, one thing that came out of his work was he was working with a VP of product development at Mattel, right? The company makes Barbies, right? And, she thought that she wanted or she needed to leave Mattel in order to, you know, I think it was to build a nonprofit, start a nonprofit, right? And instead, through his work, and I'm sure some of it is similar to some of the things you're doing, right? Is they came up with a whole new line of Barbie dolls, and I believe it was around diversity, right? So it wasn't the blonde hair, blue eyes, perfect body Barbie doll. It was around creating a whole line that like matched the experience of kids so that they had somebody authentically to look up to, right? And so, and it's become like a huge line of mm-hmm. of revenue for them, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, I'm that's kind of where that question is stemming from, right? It's like, how do we reframe our job and maybe be able to tap into the, instead of starting a nonprofit, how do I tap into the resources that I already have in order to create impact in a way that maybe doesn't involve, you know, because we talk about like finding purpose and fulfillment. That doesn't mean you have to go start a nonprofit, right? That helps get clean water to people in Africa, right? Mm-hmm. It can be something that, so as long as you're finding fulfillment and purpose in it, you might be able to use your current situation to do that. All right. Mm-hmm. So,
and you know, it's something that constantly eats at me in terms of thinking about my own career. I am more fulfilled. I enjoy what I do more now, but I wonder if I had somebody who was really pushing these tactical skills in my corner, you know, throughout my career as a sales executive, that maybe I would have stayed. Maybe I would have found a different level of passion for that work. It's not a bad, it's a great job. You can make a lot of money in sales if you're really good at it. It's hard work, but you can do it. And you don't have to be smart. I'm living proof. You don't have to be that smart to do it. But I will say that there's a bit of courage required of the leaders in these companies to do what you're talking about. I was just at a conference and heard a phenomenal speaker, and you know, he talked about bringing people into the room with you. If you're a senior leader and you're going into a meeting, go pick somebody, person in the mail room. I don't know if businesses still have mail rooms, but somebody in the mail room, somebody in a lower level position that normally wouldn't get into that boardroom, bring them with you. Sit them by your side and let them see it, because you can't be what you can't see. And that's why those Barbies are so powerful, is because no matter what color they are, what position they're, you know, dressed as, you know, whether business person, you know, sunshine Barbie, whatever it is, if a little kid can't look at that and go, oh, that looks like me, I could see how I could be that, then already their worldview is limited. And but here's the challenge. When I went to college, I was a music major, and my main instrument initially was percussion, not piano, although piano is a percussion instrument. It was the drums. And I was brought in to play the tom-toms, the quads, the ones that are like, right? Like those drums. So I was not very good at those drums, but that's what they had hired me. That's what my scholarship was, to come in and play. But during one of our first practices, the marching band director saw me playing the snare drum. You know, that one that's like, and I imagine that his, you know, internal dialogue went, damn, that kid's good at that. You know, we should get him off of the quads and put him on that. he wasn't afraid to reassign me. He wasn't afraid that, oh, where am I going to get another quad player from? It's going to mess up the alignment and all this stuff. He saw what I was good at and he tried to magnify it. And I'm not saying that every leader is like this, but there are a lot of leaders I encounter that will not let a person do what they're best at because they're afraid to lose that position on their team. You may be hired as a salesperson, but damn, you got an eye for marketing. But your sales, you're not I can't put you over on the marketing team because, you know, then I need a salesperson to backfill. That's not his problem, it's your problem. Let that person do what they're best at.
Yeah, dude, I totally agree. I mean, I think, you know, when I had my basketball company, we had a guy that I actually created three different jobs for him because I believed in him. I believed that he had, like, going back kind of what we're talking about, he had the tactical skills, right? He was good with people. He was creative. He was organized. He, you know, and people loved him, right? And so I wanted to keep him as a person, knowing that if he had the opportunity to do something that he was passionate about, that he would find fulfillment in, that was going to provide value to the company. It was going to provide value to the organization, and it was going to help him do something that he enjoyed doing. And I saw that as a win-win. Like, I think, you know, if we just get to sit down and we get to know the people and understand what they like, what they don't like, what drives them, what do they dream about, right? And then connect that to in some way, shape, or form to what the organization is doing, you can find hidden value in what your people bring to the table. Speaking on creativity, right? Something that I subconsciously probably connected with you on. I kind of consider myself a coach trapped in an artist body and all this stuff, right? So I just, you know, I love the work that you do and the creativity that you bring into your work. I think we're all, creativity is super important, especially dealing with this, the adversity and everything that we're dealing with. And I think everybody is inherently creative. I think we are inherently creative beings, and we get conditioned by society to teach us that we're not creative. And we place, you know, the judgment and the comparison and all these things that block the creative flow. You know, what are some things that people can do to tap into that creative self, even if they don't think that they're creative?
You're right. It is sort of beaten out of us. There's a book that's among my favorites, and it's The Little Prince. And in that book, the narrator, if you will, talks about forgetting what we knew. That is learning acquiring new knowledge or forgetting more knowledge? Forgetting what we knew. And it's a deep philosophical concept that would take another 30 minutes for
That's
us to really
dig
into.
That's why I titled my book Untrain.
Yeah. So it's fascinating, really. I won't go into the weeds in the philosophy because I think we'll lose anybody who's watching. But one of the things that is emblematic of a creative is stubbornness. So if people want to be more creative, I'd say one thing that they can do is become a little more stubborn and refuse to give up when there's something that they want. Find a way. Now, you might be saying, well, Greg, that sounds great, but how do I find a way? Well, I talked about earlier wanting to get people away from their titles, away from the corporate armor that we wear, and talk to them as people. But as people, we are inherently flawed when it comes to criticizing our ideas. And so what I found to be a really useful exercise is what I call the superhero. So normally we do this in a management or board development workshop, and we'll go around the table and everybody picks a superhero. So let's say you've got an idea or you've got a problem you want to solve. Write down on a piece of paper 3 or 4 different superheroes. Right? It could be Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, whatever. And then from the position of Superman, how would Superman approach solving this problem? What resources might he tap? How might he look at this problem and consider it differently? And then how might Wonder Woman do the same? And on, right? And you can do it. You could say Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Michael Jordan, you know, whatever you want to add to the mix, whoever it is, but create some alter egos for yourself so that if they come up with really stinky, crappy, no good, bad ideas, they're not Mike's or Greg's stinky, crappy, no good, bad idea. It's Bill Gates, so who cares? Whatever. And that allows us to be a bit more creative because then the onus of the result isn't on us, unless it's a good result, and then we get to take the credit because Bill Gates wasn't really there. So that's a really helpful way for
folks. That's a great exercise.
Yeah, for folks to get creative.
That's awesome, man. I love it. So one of the other things you talk about is disruption. And lots of times when we think of disruption, I think it gets framed up as something that happens to us, not something that, as you would put, that we create. How do you define disruption, and why is being a disruptor versus getting disrupted super important in today's business world?
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that because the way we define it is so important. So I define disruption as a change that sustains and sets a new standard. And those elements are important, right? Something has to change for something to be disrupted, so there's gotta be a change. It has to last. If a change doesn't last, it's an interruption. It's a TV commercial. It's an irritant. So it's gotta sustain. And it's gotta set a new standard. It's gotta either make something better or make something worse. It doesn't always have to be positive. Disruption is not always positive. But it's also never the final disruption. So when someone says, well, the question that always comes up in those keynotes when I talk about disruption is, well, how long does it have to last? Could last a day. And whatever happens next could be the next disruption. I think we get too caught up on this idea of like, whoa, disruption, man, it's Uber, it's like big, it's sexy. Well, I think that's a very limiting definition of disruption. So why not use it?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is life is impermanent. Everything is in constant change and flux. We're just dealing with it at a different rate than we've ever had to deal with it. And it's only going to increase. Like the time between, you're talking about the time, right? How long does it have to last? The time between disruptions is only going to get compressed. And I think that means that a lot of these other skills that we're talking about, being able to navigate around it, are so important that, you know, the skills that you're teaching, right? So I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead, keep going.
No, that's fine. I know there was a second part to your question, but I forget it.
The question, why is it so important to create the disruption rather than being disrupted?
It's a preference. I mean, I'm not going to say that it is important, right? You choose what's important for your life. But if we are not creating that disruption, then we're responding or reacting to the world around us. And most of us, I'd argue, wind up reacting, not actually responding. Responding implies power. It implies choice. Reaction is a little bit, you know, quicker. And then reflex, we won't get into those three. They're pretty important terms in the work that I do with disruption: response, reaction, and reflex. But This desire to self-actualize comes from growth. And most of us want to choose which direction we grow. I'm not going to say everybody. I guess some people like to get kicked around by life. But that choice is such an important part of disruption, because you choose to make a disruption. Similarly, when disruption is thrust upon you, as it is for many of us, it was that, you know, my vocal cord trauma was a disruption. Initially, I reacted, but then I chose, and I was deliberate in how I responded. And the quicker we can get past react and into respond, or really what I try to train the folks I work with to do is eliminate reaction. You have a reflex, and then you condition that reflex to become a response. That's what we really want. So the quicker that we get to that point, the more in control of our growth, the closer we are to self-actualization, the happier we become. Because we are fulfilling our natural state, our natural desire. So in that sense, it's important. What's funny is that because of the pandemic, everybody and their mom has become a disruption expert. So I've actually stopped speaking about it because I feel that there's too much chatter out there. There's too much noise. I'm trying to talk where the people aren't yet in terms of their thought process and get them there so that we can continue to advance this conversation, to those higher level thoughts.
I love where you're going with all of it, because it's funny because I wrote an article. I'm in the process of writing some content around belonging, and I talk about how we're eventually going to move up this hierarchy of needs, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and eventually work is going to be a place that people are going to find their process of self-actualization. So we are 100% on the same page there. I think that's going to be that conversation, right? Where what you're talking about right now is where belonging is right now, right? Where it's going to be. I'm not doing a good job explaining that, but you know what I'm saying,
well,
right?
Well, yeah, it's funny. Maslow's got the five levels. And what I've done is compressed levels 1 and 2. And I call that pay and benefits. Quite simply put, that's what it is. That's what a company offers to hit those two levels on Maslow's hierarchy. It's pay and benefits. The next two levels, that's culture and inclusion. That's what that is. And that's how work is attempting to hit those levels. And by every measure, work is sucking wind at all of those. Now, I'm going to have to beat a lot of heads in with a baseball bat to get pay and benefits to change the way it needs to for that level to be meaningful for most employees. It's just not. They habituate to tiny pay raises, so they don't last in terms of the difference that they make. And frankly, the benefits situation here in the U.S. anyway is an absolute nightmare and needs a lot of attention. But levels 3 and 4, culture and inclusion, we can even pull some recognition in there. I mean, that's also a mess because a lot of it is check the box culture, check the box DEI. We want you, it's really not resonating with the audience. I mean, I think if it were a play, it would have been, it would have been shut down. The Broadway stage would be dark. People would stop buying tickets. But, I guess it achieves some goal for the folks that are, for the folks that are going through it. What I'm suggesting is we make an end around right up to level 5 and help people forget the other stuff. They're already getting paid in benefits, and we're not going to stop providing DE&I training. It's the right thing to do to try to help people within these organizations be more inclusive. But if they don't have these tactical skills where they can reframe, where they can think about a problem, here's a good one. You're trying to deal with someone who may not be inclusive, who may not be accepting. And if they cannot hold an idea with one hand, hold the idea that they believe with one hand, and yet consider the idea that they may not believe or may not understand with the other, these trainings are falling on deaf ears. And that's what we see largely happening, is that it's not effective. It's not an effective use of the amount of time it's being given. I'm not saying it's not good. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying it's not penetrating the skin. The medicine is not getting where it's got to get. And it's because the minds are not ready. They're not conditioned. What conditions these minds are those skills of mental flexibility, the resilience, reframing. What conditions those minds are the skills of gratitude, energy management, even focus. I work with so many clients that are senior executives, and you'd be astonished to hear the companies they come from. And yet when we boil it down, they focus on a lot of stuff that doesn't matter. They really get hung up on it, and it drains a lot of their mental and physical energy. It saps the joy of work that they do. If they only had that skill, they could be so much more effective already. And all those other things organizations are trying to do, if we started at the top of the pyramid instead of the bottom up, boy, I love that you're on that mission too, because I think the more of us that get out there and beat this drum, the louder we are. So thanks for giving me a platform to talk about this, Mike.
Of course, man. Thanks for coming on. Where can we, if people want to hire you, people want to get to know more about your work, where's the best place to connect with you and find you?
Yeah, man. I'm pretty easily accessible on every social, on the main social media channels, right? My website is gregoryoffner.com. It's up there. I used to have glasses, got LASIK during the pandemic. So gregoryoffner.com is the best place to go. You can drop me an email, greg@gregoryoffner.com. I'd love to talk to anybody that would love to have a conversation.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's good to see you. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in on LinkedIn.
What's up, guys? Thanks for taking the time to listen to the show today. If you enjoyed the episode, we'd greatly appreciate a 5-star rating on iTunes because it's how we spread the word about the show. Also, remember to grab your copy of Locked In, a digital guide on how to unlock world-class resilient performance by heading over to mindshiftlabs.com/performance. That's mindshiftlabs.com/performance. We'll see you next week. Definition of a champion, definition of a champion, no. Never for titles before survival, the champion. A team role players even with